When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Stonehenge. Stonehenge has been on the subject of this podcast before. It is, in many ways, the most famous monument in Britain and Ireland. It is the one monument that Barack Obama, when he was president, asked if he could stop Marine One, his helicopter, and between some kind of G8 or whatever it's called, meetings. And he stopped, he landed there, and he toured around it. He was so keen to see it. It's a monument that I've visited time and again over the course of a career as we learn new things, new archaeology, new insights into Stonehenge and its surrounding area. It's always a joy. It's a place of magic, a place of mystery that draws huge crowds throughout the year, but also and especially at the solstice, at the equinox, when people get up near the stone and can lay their hands on the stones. I've attended those gatherings. I've been there in rain. I've been there in shine. I've been in the sun's coming up, peeking over the horizon, hitting the stones. I've been there when the stones are covered in snow and the skies are overcast. And it's never, ever disappointed. One of the most interesting times I visited it was actually not for work, but when my wife and I, we're blessed, we have three wonderful children, you may have heard on the podcast, but we lost one baby late in my wife's pregnancy, very late on. It was a terrible event, traumatic event. And for some reason, I don't know why, we just got in the car, we decided to take a day out and we just went to Stonehenge, went to look at the stones. And it was a very special thing to do. And I think it was a very healing thing to do as well. So Stonehenge has always been very close to my heart. It's been a very special place for me and my family. It's wonderful that the British Museum are going to do one of their huge blockbuster exhibitions on Stonehenge. They feel that we have all spent 2 years locked up on this island. Many of us haven't done the foreign travel that we've become used to, and we've re-engaged with what's around us. And nowhere more so than Stonehenge, which has seen huge numbers of visitors over the last 2 years. I'm very pleased that Neil Wilkin, he's the curator of the Stonehenge exhibition at the British Museum. He's coming on the podcast now to talk all about it. If you wish to watch a program I made at Stonehenge a year or two ago for History Hit TV, it's our own history channel. You can go and subscribe. If you click the link in the description of this podcast, you get whisked over to History Hit TV. You can subscribe on your smart TV, on your phone, on your laptop, on your tablet device for a very small amount of money. And you can watch a program at Stonehenge, one of my most successful programs ever, in fact, a documentary about Stonehenge, but also lots of other wonderful Stonehenge documentaries on there. For example, The First Britons, in which we look at some of the oldest archaeological remains of the humans that lived on this island. So lots and lots of Stonehenge material, lots of material right the way through history. So please go and check it out. But in the meantime, please enjoy this discussion with Neil Wilkin, curator of the Stonehenge exhibition at the British Museum, talking all about the stones. Enjoy. Neil, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you guys decide to do a massive Stonehenge? Is it the new stuff? Is it the fact that you realised we haven't really talked about it for a while? Like, what is it?
Yeah, well, it's all those things. It's the fact that we've never done an exhibition on Stonehenge, but it is one of, if not the most iconic monument in Britain, one of the most iconic monuments in the world. It's our version of the pyramids, if you like. So to us, that was kind of shocking that there hadn't been an exhibition on that subject. But you're right, there's also something else, which is the last 20, 30 years, there's been a lot of new excavation in the landscape around Stonehenge. There's been lots of fantastic discoveries across Britain and Europe from the time of Stonehenge. And there's been a lot of scientific discoveries, things like ancient DNA, that have really revolutionized how we can talk about not just the monument, but I think also importantly, the people who built the monument. So that was really important to us because that's where objects come in. Objects let us talk about people. So those things came together. And then there's a third thing I should mention, which is it feels like a great moment to do this exhibition because we've all been in lockdown. We've all been kind of going out and maybe appreciating nature a bit more, appreciating the British countryside a bit more. So it feels like just that time when people are starting to ask some questions about the kind of deep past, the deep history of the landscape that they've been enjoying walking around during this kind of really difficult couple of years. So that's the other aspect. It feels like the right time to do this show.
Totally, man. I think we're all reconnecting with, well, I'm not because I spend my whole goddamn life in those places anyway, but I think lots of people are reconnecting with the world-class heritage that is on our doorstep from Orkney to Cornwall. I completely agree. So let's just rehearse what we think we know about Stonehenge. Where are we 5,000 years ago, do we think?
So the first monument at Stonehenge is built 5,000 years ago. But kind of amazingly, and this is something we touch on in the exhibition at the BM, there's lots going on in that Stonehenge landscape thousands of years before the first Stonehenge is built. So it's clearly an important place even before 5,000 years ago. But it's 5,000 years ago that the first monument comes into being, and that's with the blue stones. Amazingly, they're brought from Wales all the way to Salisbury Plain.
4,500 years, of course, Great Pyramid of Giza. So that it is, as you say, kind of pyramid contemporary. Let's talk about that landscape, though, because that's really important, your point. It is obviously a sacred space, even well before Stonehenge. Now, I'm dredging up the memory banks here, but is that something because the chalk downland that would have been very heavily wooded in southern England, but that would have been a big open area of open heathland? How do we describe that?
Yeah, exactly. So when you visit today, you see a really open landscape, and that's been very carefully managed by English Heritage and National Trust. And that really is how the landscape would have appeared for much of the time that the Stonehenge monument was being visited and worshipped. And what you have to remember is that the rest of the country and much of it is still under tree cover, under wood, and is unimproved land. So I think as an area of open landscape, that's really interesting if you're not used to it. But I think also as rich agricultural land, that's somewhere you can have your animals, your cattle. But there's another aspect that I kind of really realized when I visited this week with a group of colleagues we were visiting. And the thing that I'd kind of been missing was that big landscape means that there's a big sky. You know, when you don't have tree cover, when you've got these sort of rolling areas, the sky is somehow more present. You're more aware of what's happening with the movement of the sun and no doubt at nighttime with the stars. So I'm sure that in terms of thinking about your place in the world, which is what Stonehenge does, it lets people sort of find their place in the world and celebrate and anchor that. The sky and its presence is a really important aspect of why the monument's there.
What's the latest thinking on how they did get those stones from Wales?
I think it's a combination of sheer determination and the use of water to help a little bit. But clearly, for the vast majority of the route, they had to take those blue stones over land. And I think you can't underestimate the amount of effort that was needed. And I think what that tells you, I mean, I'm sort of moving the question on a bit, but I think what it tells you is how much people wanted to move those stones, because it's such an undertaking and such a logistic nightmare. Because remember, these people who are moving the stones have got other things to do. They are farmers. They have to look after their crops and their animals. So to give up the time to move those stones and problem solve about how to get them over hill and dale, I think you need to have a real passion and a real religious almost fervor that this is the right thing to do. And that by moving these stones, you're really going to solve your problems or at least make a real statement to the gods. So I think while the details of how they moved them are still a little bit cloudy, the fact they did it tells us a lot about their investment in the plan.
I think it also tells us about this idea of national identity. Like if you're moving stuff from Wales, you're obviously kind of, are you crossing a tribal, familial, I don't know, state, whatever the word is, like boundaries. And that's what's really interesting about Stonehenge. It does look like it's a place for the whole of the island of Britain, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. On that trip, you know, they must have encountered other villages, other people. And can you imagine the spectacle? All of a sudden, someone with a huge blue stone comes over the horizon. I mean, you're not going to forget that. That's going to be a really memorable moment. But also, as you say, it's a moment where people are meeting and maybe joining in. So maybe the locals join in and they help move that stone for a bit of the journey. But to go back to the kind of technology of it, because I think that is important. What we know from that time, from things like the sweep track, is that people were very skilled at building these wooden walkways and trackways. And there's no doubt from new research by Dr. Mike Pitts that they're probably using these trackway-like structures to move the stones along, to aid the movement of them. So they're using their engineering skills that they've picked up in building other wooden walkways and trackways to inform how to move the bluestones as well.
So we get this initial first Stonehenge. Now, what about the really big stones from slightly nearer? They're still a long way away. When do they get added?
Would you believe they come to the site 500 years after the bluestones? And they're the Saracen stones. So they probably come from the Marlborough Downs. And it's not a million miles from Stonehenge. It's about 20, 30 kilometers. But as you know, they're so massive that they pose different types of challenge. The sheer logistics of moving really massive, heavy stones, any kind of distance, is one that people have been puzzling over for a long time. And again, we think that wooden trackways as a kind of way of sliding those stones along would have been really important. And one theory is that there was a kind of continuous trackway that ran like a train line, you know, that ran from the quarry site, which is, we currently think, somewhere like West Woods and near Marlborough, all the way to the Stonehenge construction site. And you know, that's an astonishing thing to think of, this sort of trackway that's extending right across the landscape at this really early time, before roads, before good evidence for wheeled transport. You've got this sort of trackway. So a really major piece of engineering.
You listen to Dan Snow's History. We're talking Stonehenge. More coming up.
The Ides of March, the 15th of March, it's perhaps the most famous, or shall we say infamous, day in the ancient history world, because it was on that day in 44 BC that Julius Caesar, dictator of Rome, was assassinated in a Senate meeting. But what do we know about the events of the Ides of March 44 BC? Did Shakespeare get anything right? And what happened next? Well, every Sunday, this March on the Ancients from History Hit, we're going to find out. This is the time for our special mini-series of episodes all about the Ides of March, the events of the day itself, the legacy of this day in ancient history, some of the characters involved, and so much more. So make sure you tune into the Ancients from History Hit every Sunday for our special Ides of March mini-series.
Did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you're using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Okay, well, this is the big question. Do you think it was ever completed?
Yeah, I personally think it was completed.
I hope it was. I want it to have been.
Do you? Yeah, I think it's nice to think that the investment that they put into doing those, you know, what we see today, if you're going to put that kind of investment in, then you're probably invested in finishing the job, and you've definitely got the skills to finish the job, let's face it. So I like to think that it was a full circle. But as you allude to, because it's not complete now and there are missing stones, you can't be entirely sure that it was ever a complete circle.
So we can't be sure. We all hope it was completed, because it just hurts the brain if they ever even completed it. Dare we wonder what it meant?
Yeah, so something the exhibition does is it kind of makes the point that we've been making, which is that the monument isn't just one monument. You know, we've talked about two different phases, but actually there was multiple phases in the construction where stones were moved around. And over that time period of about really 1,500 years when the monument was being modified and changed, new stones brought in, other stones moved around. During that time, there's no doubt that its meaning also shifted. So one myth we're trying to explode in the exhibition is that it meant one thing for all time. In fact, it's quite clear that it meant different things. And to just give an example of that, we have objects from the first Stonehenge, that blue stone monument in the exhibition. And at that point, the monument was a cemetery. So it was a place for the cremated dead. And amazingly, some scientific research suggests that some of those cremated individuals were being brought, the cremated bones were being brought from Wales. So it wasn't just the blue stones that were moving, it was potentially people's ancestors, people's relatives that were making the same journey to this new homeland, this new area or this ceremonial area that was set aside. So it's a big cemetery to begin with. And then by the time the big sarsens come in, so 500 years after the blue stones, the monument has shifted its meaning, and it's a very clean site, which really frustrates museum curators and archaeologists because there aren't a huge amount of objects from that period. But that's a really important fact. The absence is really important. Like a cathedral, the monument's been kept really clean. And we think by that point, its meaning, its purpose is much more ceremonial, to do with those solstice events that everyone hears about in the summer and the winter in the news. You see pictures of people celebrating at Stonehenge. Those were also really important way back in the time of the Saracens. So it was a place of ceremony and a place of gathering. What's quite interesting is that the monument isn't massive. That's often a comment that people make. It's not as big as I thought it would be. And that's quite interesting too, because clearly not everyone in those ceremonies could fit within the inner sanctum of the circle. So is there a sense in which the monument is also to do with social relations? Who's important, who's not? Who's religious, who's not? So there's an element to which the monument's also telling us about the way in which people were maybe separated by access to the monument by that point. And then if I can go on a bit, the monument, after it's become a ceremonial place, becomes a focus point for burial. So when you stand inside Stonehenge and look outside it, the landscape, the horizon's dotted with these bumps and barrows, burial mounds, where the dead were placed. And so after it's become a ceremonial site, it becomes this sort of almost like a Mecca-like sanctum where people want to be buried close to gain that kind of relationship or connection to as important members of society who are buried in that landscape. So that's just three different examples of how over its life, its meaning changed. And those are things that we can start to unpick through the objects that we show through the different areas of the exhibition.
I'm fascinated by the animal bones, the burials, the metal objects. Like, what else do we learn about relations with Europe or other parts of this island or archipelago that we live on? What? Keep telling me.
Yeah, very interesting. So around the time the Saracens come to Stonehenge, there's another huge monument, which you may have heard of, called Durrington Walls, which is down the river, down the Avon from Stonehenge. And it seems to be really intimately connected with what's happening at Stonehenge around 4,500 years ago. And it's been described as a kind of part sacred site, part camp for the workers who are building the Saracen version of Stonehenge. And at that site, there's lots of evidence. Unlike Stonehenge, which I said is kept quite clean like a cathedral, down at Durrington Walls, that's where the sort of Glastonbury-style parties are happening. And you've got people feasting on barbecued pork and probably something with a bit more of an edge, alcoholic drinks from containers called grooveware pots. All those things are in the exhibition. Those evidence of feasting and partying are in the show. But to answer your point about connections, some recent scientific work on the pigs that are brought to Stonehenge for these big pork barbecues. Those pigs seem to have come from pretty far away, and there's still a bit of debate about how far away, but some people think they're coming and being driven to Stonehenge from maybe as far away as Scotland even. That's one theory, or at least from a really pretty far hinterland around the monument. So you've got that sense of people coming together, perhaps around the winter solstice, that's what the pig bone evidence seems to suggest, and having these big parties in advance of going to Stonehenge and either constructing the monument or worshipping at the monument.
We haven't said the obvious bit yet, which is tell me about its solar alignment.
Lots of really excellent work being done on different alignments with the moon and sun, but the point I'd make is that the key solar alignments to do with the way the whole monument is orientated, its key axes, and the way you approach it down the avenue, those are on the midsummer sunrise and the midwinter sunset, so the solstices. And the reason those are so important, something we really go to town on in the exhibition, is that the sun for farmers is, as you know, completely critical. It's the thing that brings the calendar round, that helps your crops to grow. And at that midwinter point, there's that fear, I suppose, and I think we still get it when we get the January blues, there's a fear that it's winter and it's dark and it might not get light again. You might not get your summer. So that sort of moment when the sun is at its weakest, that seems to be the time when people really wanted to undertake these ceremonies, perhaps to guarantee, to ensure, to celebrate the fact that there was going to be light again. There was going to be the return of life, perhaps to do with the ancestors as well, the return regeneration of the dead at that kind of critical turning moment.
I tell you, if I could have witnessed any scene in history, it would have been one of those moments.
Yeah, it'd be great.
We do know more than we used to, but we don't really know anything about those people. I mean, we don't know how they were organized and their politics. It's just so fascinating, isn't it?
There is a frustration to it as well, obviously, and it's something that we've been very careful to try and address in the exhibition, is we don't have named individuals. We don't even have the kind of tribe names that you get later on in the Celtic Iron Age period. So you can't really talk about that. But what you can show is that people shared lots of things. They shared the same type of pottery between Orkney and Stonehenge. People that visited Orkney for midwinter or midsummer would be using the same types of pot as they did at Stonehenge. And I find that amazing, because we think, oh, well, both of those are in what we know as the UK. But before the UK, before the nation states, that distance between Orkney up in the north and down here in southern England is a major trip, a major undertaking. And yet it feels like, it seems like people were capable of making those journeys, or that the culture of the islands of Ireland and Britain was similar enough that people were doing the same sorts of things. So does that mean they're speaking the same language? I would say there's a pretty high chance they were. It doesn't mean they understood and worshipped the same principles and gods. Again, I would say, given the similarities between what's happening in Ireland and Brúna Boyne, the Boyne Valley, and what's happening up in Stenness in Orkney and Brodgar there, and what's happening in Avebury and Stonehenge, I would say that the similarities between those monuments, the things that we call henges and stone circles, you would say these people are worshipping the same sorts of ideas, principles, and religious ideas. And so to me, you're right, we can't get at the detail, but you can start to unpick the connections. And that's what we do in the show. You can say, look at the art on tombs in Orkney. Isn't it similar to the chalk objects that you find in East Yorkshire? And to my mind, that's going to be a real revelation to people visiting the exhibition, those long distance links.
What do you know about the fall of Stonehenge? Did it ever fall? Did it lose its centrality in British spiritual life?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that it did start to lose its appeal and its power. And I think that happened at a very interesting time in the history of these islands. And it happened around the time that metal, bronze, the first sort of metal to be introduced, started to become dominant. And with that, trade links, particularly between the south of England and the continent, so France really, became much more important as a way of connecting to sources of power. But also, I think we have to remember that the exchanges that are happening are not sort of dry economic exchanges. The objects that people are acquiring have sort of spiritual or even cosmological power invested within them. So the people who had access to metal particularly along the south coast of England, start to be able to command greater power. And it's around that time that you see modifications to Stonehenge starting to shift. And something really interesting happens at Stonehenge, and that is that people start to almost graffiti the monument. And what they start to carve onto the stones, and there's hundreds of these, and if you can get close enough to the stones, you can just about see them. They start to carve metal objects. They start to carve representations of axes and daggers onto the stones. And that in many ways symbolizes this new world that's emerging around 4,000 years ago, where metal is the power that makes the world go round, if you like. That's the time that you start to see modifications to the monument stopping. And as I say, more elaborate burials and objects are now located further south within access of the channel or the North Sea. And that's a major moment. It's a major moment in the history of the country, and it's a major moment in the history of Stonehenge as well.
It's the kids. The kids with their new toys. They're turning away from the old ways.
New materials and new ideas. You know, it was always so, wasn't it? You know, that's what always happens. You get these revolutions of material. You get the latest iPhone. You get silicon chips. It changes who has the access to the power. So it's now Silicon Valley rather than the industrial heartlands. It has that effect. Stonehenge is left. But what I find fascinating is that it's not knocked down. Thank God it's not knocked down by anyone. Even in more religious times, when some of these sites are considered pagan and potentially evil, the stones are left. And that does suggest that even after it lost its real influence, there's still a sense of respect and wonder for those hanging lintels, those standing stones.
Kids, they're not reading books anymore. They're on their TikToks. That's the problem with these kids. Okay, Neil, thank you very much indeed. I mean, we could do a whole separate thing about the life of Stonehenge through recorded history, which I think is fascinating, and maybe you'd let us talk to you about that at some stage. The exhibition, which I'm looking forward to coming to you very much, is when?
The exhibition closes on the 17th of July. So a good few months for people to visit and see some of what I think are the wonders of ancient Europe, objects that really hopefully put Stonehenge in context.
Very special indeed. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Dan.
I feel we have the history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished.
For more about Stonehenge, History Hit's February book of the month was How to Build Stonehenge by Mike Pitts. Check it out. Thanks, folks, for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History. As I say all the time, I love doing these podcasts. They are the best thing I do professionally. I feel very lucky to have you listening to them. If you fancied giving them a rating and review, obviously the best rating review possible would be ideal. It makes a big difference to us. I know it's a pain, but we'd really, really be grateful. And if you want to listen to the other podcasts in our ever-increasing stable, don't forget we've got Susanna Lipscomb with Not Just the Tudors. That's flying high in the charts. We've got our medieval podcast, Gone Medieval, with the brilliant Matt Lewis and Kat Jarman. We've got The Ancients with our very own Tristan Hughes. And we've got Warfare as well, dealing with all things military. Please go and check those out wherever you get your pods.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.